This week on Your Western Context, a new report uncovers a Chinese police station in Vancouver. Alberta secures children's pain medication, and Veterans Affairs offers medical assistance in dying to veterans. Also, First Nations and Northern MPs speak out against Trudeau's gun ban bill. This is Western Context, episode 298, recorded Saturday, December 10th, 2022. A challenging balance. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here, as we are each and every week and have been since 2017.
Yes, indeed. We're here to give the news as it pertains to Canadians all across the country. And certainly there's a lot of news out there this week that has been not really been reported on as it should have been. There's definitely lots of news that has gone uncovered or almost swept under the rug. And these are really important stories that should matter to Canadians.
That's right, and we do that each and every week here. We have stories that have, in many ways, been months or sometimes years ahead of where the Canadian media was, and we continue that trend this week, talking about what the Canadian media has finally realized and what they're still continuing to miss on some of these stories. And we have a full slate on the podcast this week for that. And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is the podcast that aims to remove all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the news and media. And in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin this week with our BC story. But before we dive headfirst into that, I just want to remind our listeners about our fall survey that you can find at westerncontext.ca/FS. We're going to be using this survey to guide where we take the podcast in the new year. So if you have a few minutes, we wouldn't mind. Just head on over to westerncontext.ca/FS, fill out the survey, tell us what you think about the show, what you'd like to see about the show going forward, and any demographic info that we ask for is 100% optional, so you don't need to provide it if you don't want to. But once again, we'd appreciate it if you just take a couple minutes and fill out our survey at westerncontext.ca/FS. And with that, we move into BC, where we are reviewing the case of Chinese influence in Canada.
Yes, and it was 2 months ago on Western Context 290, where we discussed a story talking about the Chinese communist government setting up police stations around the world, including in Canada, in order to monitor and so-called correct the activities of the Chinese diaspora around the world. Now, somehow the story was covered in a few outlets, and then it was promptly ignored, even though the idea of a foreign power operating so blatantly and overtly in Canada should have been headline news and a major embarrassment for the federal government. However, since then, there's been little focus on the matter. Safeguard Defenders, the Spanish-based civil rights group that originally investigated and found at least 54 police stations operated by Chinese police around the world, they released their original report back in September, and they released a follow-up this week that has uncovered another 48, bringing the total to 102 in 53 different countries around the world. Now, the two most recent stations uncovered in Canada, including the Vancouver station, as well as another in an unknown location, add to the three stations that the group allegedly located in Toronto and that are now currently under investigation by the RCMP. Now, the report looked into how these police stations function under a, quote, persuasion of return strategy, using intimidation and threats to enforce the involuntary return of immigrants back to China for persecution. Now, the group claimed that between April 2021 and July of 2022, Chinese police around the world persuaded 230,000 claimed fugitives to return to China. And now I know what you're thinking at this point. Well, what does it matter? These are criminals. Well, this could also refer to political dissidents or people that are citizens of different countries, such as Singapore, Malaysia, Canada, even the United States as well. That could be citizens of those countries and and are just trying to live their lives. And because they may have spoken out in the past against the Chinese Communist government, or maybe they have family that have done as such, they could be under threat from these Chinese police stations for politically correct actions. Now, the report said that the newly documented Vancouver-based police station is being operated by authorities from Wenzhou in China's Zhejiang province. Now, no one from the Chinese embassy in Canada was immediately available for comment on the new information, but it has previously described the offices as volunteer-run service stations to process things like driver's license. They also mentioned that many of these stations were set up after the dark times of the past couple of years in order to help Chinese citizens around the world try and access things like that you would normally access at an embassy, or being able to access flights home. But we know that this isn't the case, because the report claims that many of these were actually set up in the period between 2016 and 2019, which is, of course, before all of the dark times that first came out of China back in late 2019, early 2020 even happened. Now, Safeguard Defenders alleges that the stations are involved in what is known as a persuasion to return tactic of operations. Now, the group says that evidence shows individuals connected to these stations have been involved in persuading nationals suspected of committing crimes to return to China to face criminal proceedings. Now, the Chinese government also previously claimed that the stations were only set up to help Chinese nationals living overseas during the pandemic. However, the Safeguard Defenders claims that the vast majority of the 48 newly documented stations were set up back in 2016. Now, in September, the RCMP declared it was investigating the Toronto-based stations for, quote, reports of criminal activity in relation to the so-called police stations. Now, the RCMP also said that it takes threats to the security of individuals living in Canada very seriously and is aware that foreign states may seek to intimidate or harm communities or individuals within Canada. Now, Victor Ho, who is the former editor of the Canadian version of the Tsingtao Daily, which is Canada's largest Chinese-Canadian newspaper, and also he is a Hong Kong democracy advocate, said that he was not surprised to hear the news and that it has created a lot of insecurity in the Chinese-Canadian community. Ho said, quote, "It doesn't matter if they're from Hong Kong, from the mainland, from Taiwan, even from Singapore or Malaysia, because their human security will be jeopardized by this so-called police station. It deals with not only with mainlanders, but overseas Chinese people. You may be subject to be criticized or selected by these so-called police stations, and they could harass you or come to your office to make known their presence." Now, Ho said that this is a very dangerous scenario and sends a message that the Chinese government doesn't honor any international law. He said, quote, "With this Chinese policing station, they're kind of a hidden police authority, but without consent of local government. So it also violates police sovereignty here." Now, someone who may be a target of these Chinese police operations would be someone who is an economic fugitive or a political dissident, and someone who is vocal about their opposition to the Chinese Communist Party would also be at risk. Now, Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Melanie Joly, told reporters recently that 2022 has revealed that the tectonic plates of the world power structures are moving, and called China an, quote, "increasingly disruptive global power." However, for those who have been paying attention, 2022 has not been the start of this movement, as China has had these global ambitions in the works for a very long time. And anyone who has studied 20th and 21st century Chinese history knows that their government works on decades-long plans, and that we need to remember that this month is the four-year anniversary of the Chinese government arresting and jailing the two Michaels, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, under dubious circumstances in response to the detainment of Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou. Now, the fact that nobody has responded to this follow-up report from the Safeguard Defenders, either from the RCMP, the Prime Minister's office, or even anyone else in government for that matter, or even the Chinese embassy with their clearly false excuses, is deplorable. Now, the fact that a foreign power can operate these stations in Canada seemingly without impunity, and that we do not even know what follow-up actions are being taken to address this situation, means that this issue seems to be swept under the rug. It's important that people know about what's happening in Canada and how these problems are going to be fixed, and not talking about them does not mean that they will just go away.
Yeah, and of course that's imagination land. Not thinking about your problems makes them go away and whatnot. But in reality, you can't live there, and that's definitely something that seems to be happening in the case of this story. And when we first saw the fact that there were three, and they were in Eastern Canada, and now we see one in Vancouver, and Safeguard Defenders has unearthed even more of them in even more countries, it really raises the question that needs to be asked. Just how many of these are there throughout the world, and how many of them are here in Canada, and how successful have they been? And as a result of that, we don't know the answer to those questions. And we don't know exactly what methods they're undertaking when they confront these Chinese Canadians at this point to try and get them to go home. Are they using intimidation tactics? Are they suggesting that families, members back home will be hurt or worse? Are they even suggesting that they might be abducted and sent back to China? Because we know that's a thing that happens in countries that are closer geographically to China, and we don't know if anything like that has happened here. We hope that hasn't happened, but this is definitely a story that needs to be raising the eyebrows of more Canadians and more government officials at this point in time.
Yeah, exactly. The fact remains is that even after months of investigation by this group, this has been going on for at least 3 months now that we know of, that we've been aware of these police stations, we still don't know any progress on what's actually being done. Now, of course, it's been mentioned that many think that CSIS maybe is allowing some of these police stations to continue operating under their knowledge just to gain intelligence on a foreign power and to try and get more information on how these police stations operate so that they can uncover more of them. And while that may be the case, you know, we already know that these exist in Canada, and we know that a bunch of them are already here. And, we have a very large Chinese-Canadian population in Canada, quite a few in Toronto, of course, and quite a few in BC. When we saw the first story that said that there were at least three in Toronto, it seemed very likely that there would be some in BC as well. And the fact remains, we only still know of at least one of them. There may be more, and there could be some in Victoria. There could be more on the mainland. We don't know exactly what's going on. And that's a problem, because it's a huge problem that's happening in Canada right now, where citizens of Canada could be threatened or coerced or even kidnapped by foreign power. And we've seen this happen before. And I think that that's something that should be taken very seriously. And the fact that we don't know anything further on this story really raises the possibility of something else going on.
Yeah, and in many ways, this is a classic Western context story. And at the beginning of our time here, we had the assumption that something like this might be happening and there might be some form of Chinese influence on our country. We just didn't know how widespread it was and what they were doing here. But now more and more, that's becoming clear. And we've been talking about this since, I think, episode 5 of the podcast. And it's something that has always, that we've always kept our eye on. And in doing that, we do that for many news stories each and every week. And if you want to help us do that, you can check us out on Patreon. If you want to support the podcast monetarily, just head over to patreon.com/westerncontext. And there we offer three tiers of support. Starting at $2 a month, you'll be helping us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, of course, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month. And that article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that being said, we're moving into the Alberta story right now, and this Alberta story unearthed the huge problem in our country that we knew existed back in November. It was talked about a bit, but is still needing to be talked about today, and that's a drug shortage in the country. And what's been focused on, of course, is the shortage of children's pain and fever medication. And to help rectify that, Alberta has secured 5 million bottles of the medication. Now, that should have been the main story this week, but this week the media and the opposition NDP were making hay over the quick passage of the Alberta Sovereignty Within a United Canada Act, otherwise known as the Sovereignty Act. Now, the real story, of course, is on that pain medication and the medication shortage in general, because with the continued pressure of the fall virus season and the triple whammy of RSV, the flu, and COVID, like it or not, there's been a shortage of medication across the country. And with this, Alberta has set in motion a plan to fix that problem. And while news of this being fixed was slipping away, the Sovereignty Act was passed very early morning on Thursday. Now, if we go back to our previous show coverage on this and we look at what the media has been saying, we look at what the opposition was saying, you look what various stakeholder groups have been saying, unions, protesters that have been very small. It was a bill that needed to be stopped, in their opinion. Now, with that and taking the cues and reading the room of the media and the people who are protesting against the bill, you'd think that this would be something that the opposition NDP would put the full force of their opposition caucus behind, which isn't small. It's actually decently sized. You'd think that they'd put the full force of that caucus behind them, but no, they didn't. At 1:01 a.m. on Thursday, seven of the NDP opposition, or about a third of them, actually showed up and voted against the bill. And for context here, the opposition NDP has a caucus size of 23, and only seven of them were present to vote against this bill. And that's really important when you think about it, because this bill has been held up as one of the worst things to happen in Alberta history by the opposition, and it's garnered media coverage as such. But when push came to shove to vote on the final motion of this, only seven of the NDP actually showed up, and the media was being dishonest with this as well, because the file footage they used to talk about the vote showed a full NDP caucus, but if you look at the actual Hansard of what happened, you'll see that only seven of them showed up, and that didn't even include NDP leader Rachel Notley. And this was the main story of the week in the media, and as we see, the opposition didn't even muster a full caucus vote on third and final reading. But the real story of the week was, of course, the fact that Alberta secured 5 million bottles of children's pain and fever medication. And this was an acquisition that was made by Alberta Health Services, which in the past has been commended for leading the continent in securing the necessary supplies for viral testing. And going forward, after approval, it'll only be a couple of weeks until the medication starts arriving in stores and pharmacies across the province. And to help make sure that the pharmacies don't put too much of a cost on this, the Alberta government plans to actually subsidize the purchase, since they did pay a premium of this. So the idea is that pharmacies will then sell it at a regular sticker price to people that need it. And then, since it is the giving season, of course, Alberta then plans to share the surplus, what we don't need, with other provinces across the country. Now, this is interesting because, of course, as we mentioned, the province is paying higher than sticker price on this, and it raises a lot of questions about why we need to resort to this and what other options there are. And there's always, of course, been the option of going to your pharmacist if you need a children's grade Tylenol or Advil or something to that effect, and just asking the pharmacist to make it in a liquid, because that's what pharmacists go to school for, and they have the ingredients most of the time behind the shelf, and they're able to mix something up like that if somebody asks for it. So that's another option that might be available as well if anybody needs that who's listening to the podcast. Now, with this, the story also should raise eyebrows across the entire country, because when we look at this, this looks like an Alberta story. But it turns out that as many as 800 drugs are in short supply, and 23 of which are actually considered critical. And this can be chalked up to supply chain issues, governments not lining up contracts correctly, or, as many would expect at this time of year, just an increase in demand. But that doesn't get anybody off the hook, because what this exposes here is a web of junk from the media obscuring at least two or three other important stories in this. From the media's sole focus of the Sovereignty Act to missing a health committee meeting this week regarding these drug shortages and saying that of the 800 drugs that are considered to be in short supply, 23 of them are critical, and to not have any media coverage on that health committee meeting this week at the federal level is just downright absurd that that happened. And, of course, we also have to look at the ramifications of what happens with this in Alberta, given the fact that we have an election coming up in the spring. And this should raise many questions for everybody listening to this podcast about whether or not the upcoming Alberta election will be covered fairly and thoroughly. And with this, it appears as though Alberta's actions that we have taken have uncovered more than one other problem in our province, the other being with the media, coverage on Sovereignty Act versus health medication, and of course the severe drug shortage in our country, which, both of which, nobody's talking about, except everybody, of course, is talking about the big shiny object in the room, the Alberta Sovereignty Act. And this is why we're talking about this on Western Context this week, because this is just a web of stories that was absolutely missed by the media focusing on their hype and sensationalism.
Yes, it's amazing to see just how much controversy and coverage that the Sovereignty Act has been able to generate over the past month or so, but all the actual real issues that pertain to Albertans, such as the story about the missing and the shortage of the pain medication, especially for children, did not really generate much attention, especially given the fact that the Alberta government made steps to actually secure the passage of a lot of these drugs into Canada, which is something that could have been done on a federal level, of course, but certainly Alberta taking the proactive stance to try and fix the problem that has been going on across the entire country. And for anyone who's gone to a grocery store recently, if you take a trip down the aisle near the pharmacy that has a lot of these pain medications, we'll know that many of them are just completely out of stock and there's just empty shelves. And people have, of course, had to get used to a lot of empty shelves over the past couple of years with supply chain issues. But this is something that's even worse, given the fact that there's so many different flu viruses going around and that many people are suffering and even having to be hospitalized, even children. This is something that we're seeing these days, is that healthcare in Canada has really taken its toll, and there's a lot of issues with people trying to access healthcare. And even simple things like getting some cold medicine is not as easy to do as it should be. And I think that that's a story that really just didn't get covered very much, and is something that really matters to ordinary Canadians, especially as soon as they get sick. And that's something that should have been talked about more, but just wasn't.
Yeah, and you wind this whole thing back. Of course, we ended the story talking about drug shortages nationally, Alberta swinging in to save the day and then spreading the surplus around the country, and then, of course, the Sovereignty Act, which was first missed. And you have bang, bang, boom, three separate stories there that needed to be covered better, and the media didn't. And that's precisely why we're here. And we're going to move on to our other Canada story this week. And this is something, of course, there's the whole idea of a slippery slope and whatnot. And we always hope that that is not true, but it appears as though we're kind of heading in this direction on this next story.
Yes, a news story appeared last week, but has since received a ton of international coverage, including in the US, the United Kingdom, as well as other countries around the world. And has, quite frankly, embarrassed Canada on the world stage. Now, in this story, a paraplegic former member of the Canadian military shocked MPs last week by testifying that the Department of Veteran Affairs offered her in writing the opportunity for a medically assisted death and even offered to provide the equipment. Now, this was retired Corporal Christine Gauthier, who competed for Canada at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Paralympics, as well as the Invictus Games that same year. Now, she spoke before the House of Commons Veterans Committee and agreed to provide a copy of the letter, and she testifying that she had been fighting for a home wheelchair ramp for 5 years with no luck. Now, in response, she said that the Department of Veteran Affairs said that if she was so desperate, that the department could offer MAID, or medical assistance in dying. Now, Gauthier said that the offer came during a phone call with the Veteran Affairs caseworker, where she was describing her deteriorating condition. Back in 1989, Gauthier suffered permanent damage to her knees and spine after jumping into a deep hole while training on an obstacle course in the military. Now, she said that the fight to get a wheelchair ramp installed at her house, quote, was just getting too much and unbearable. And the person at VAC mentioned at that point, well, you know, that we can assist you with assisted dying now if you'd like. And she said that she was just shocked because she said, are you serious? Like, that's easy. You're going to be helping me to die, but you won't help me to live. And that's really telling of what's going on in Canada these days, that it's so much easier for governmental departments to offer people to die rather than helping them to live. Now, in Justin Trudeau's defense, he quickly called the report of what happened to Gauthier absolutely unacceptable and said that the government took action the moment that it heard of other cases. And he said, quote, we're following up with investigations and we are changing protocols to ensure that what should seem obvious to all of us, that it is not the place of Veteran Affairs Canada, who are supposed to be there to support those people who stepped up to serve their country, to offer them medical assistance in dying. Now, Veterans Minister Lawrence McAuley revealed last week in testimony before the same committee that four, and perhaps five, cases of Canadian military veterans being given the medical assistance in dying option by a now suspended veterans service agent have been referred to the RCMP. And McAuley said, quote, we remain confident that this is all related to one single employee and that it's not a widespread or systemic issue. However, the problem still exists. Another veteran who testified on Thursday, retired Corporal Bruce Boncour, said that at a meeting 2 weeks ago, a deputy minister at the department tried to assure an advisory committee that includes veterans that what they were facing was an isolated incident. And Moncour said, quote, 5 days later, we found out through the media that that was all lies. So we're having literally an assistant deputy minister lying to veterans' faces 5 days before the truth comes out. So I said it's disheartening, to say the least. Now, at last week's committee meeting, Conservative MP Blake Richards asked McAuley about a veteran who came forward on the podcast Tango Romeo about being offered MAID back in November of 2021. And McAuley told the committee that the story described on the podcast was not one of the four confirmed cases, suggesting that there may be even more veterans who have been offered medical assistance in dying. Now, Trudeau tried reassurance, saying that the employees in question no longer have contact with veterans, and he also acknowledged that these cases fit within a larger debate over the expansion of medical assisted dying in Canada to include those with mental illness, and that could become an option next spring when MPs will end up voting on that. Now, Trudeau said, quote, the issue of medical assistance in dying is a deeply personal, extraordinarily difficult choice that individuals and families need to make in the most thoughtful and best supported way possible. We understand that making sure that we are respecting people's rights and their choices at the same time as we protect the most vulnerable is a very important but challenging balance to establish. And, well, a challenging balance is indeed the case, because there are already news reports of people wanting to choose the medical assistance in dying option because they're poor and unable to get ahead in life, or even simply because they can't access healthcare. Oftentimes, it is quicker to get a response for medical assistance in dying than it is for healthcare services to allow someone to live. And this is unacceptable, and it's clear that more than ever that Canada's healthcare system is in total crisis. Now, if governmental departments are offering to kill people rather than to take care of them, as governments should, then this government has entirely lost its way and must be given the chance to change so that a new one can fix the issues properly.
This story is one that is a very touching subject for many people. And when the first medical assistance in dying legislation was passed, it was as a result of decisions that were made by the Supreme Court of Canada. And further expansions to medical assistance in dying were as a result of the same court rulings that push things even further and further down the track. And what you have here in Canada, of course, this is a decision that is, of course, rendered by the Supreme Court. Then the legislation was carried out by the federal government. And because of the Canada Health Act and because how healthcare is set up in our country, you wind up in a situation where the services being offered, in this case, medical assistance in dying, comes from the government, and it's a government-run agency doing that. And this is for many people who have the privilege of experiencing different healthcare systems. This is exactly the nightmare that they have been told about happening before. And this is when you look at the fact that this showed up in not just American publications, but international publications across the Atlantic. This really raises a ton of questions about just what exactly is happening here. And why these safeguards are not in place. Because when the program first came in, people were told that it would only be for people with terminal illnesses. And there was, of course, an argument to be made that you're allowing people that decision, to make that decision on their own. And then it expanded further and further, and it's going to expand even further. And as a result of that, we have this more than a handful of cases now where it's been offered to people who are not living with a terminal condition. And that is something that if this were more widely known in the Canadian public, people could have seen that, oh, well, maybe back when this was being talked about in 2015, maybe there would have been a little bit more blowback to the decision and then subsequent legislation.
Yes, and the story that really is not getting told here is the fact that this option is being offered unprompted to people who don't even ask for it. And that's something that is really troubling to find. And now the government is quick to say that these are just isolated incidents from just one person who is being investigated by the RCMP. But it's clear that there's other cases of this happening. And the fact that doctors are even signing off on people to have medical assistance in dying that really don't have terminal illnesses, only the inability to access healthcare or inability to access proper jobs due to medical disabilities that make it so that they can't get ahead in life, that this option is even there for these types of people is troubling. And I think that's something that when it comes down to it, things like government pensions or disability payments or even things like the actual healthcare system should be covering for. But instead, it seems like the government is wanting to expand these programs to include more and more people because it's a more economically efficient way of dealing with population. And I think that that's something that should raise a lot of eyebrows because when it was first brought in, it was said that this option would only be there in extreme circumstances. And now we're finding that many more people than that are trying to access this. And it just goes to show the lack of care and attention and funding for things like mental illnesses in the country and the lack of access for healthcare for everyday ordinary people around the country. And I think that this whole story with this Paralympian who was offered this from Veteran Affairs. It's just one case, but we're seeing that it's not just one case. And I think that that's something that really got missed in the media this week.
Yeah, and of course, that's why we're talking about this. This is the bread and butter of Western Context. Previously, these stories used to only be one in a few, but it feels as though we have these coming up each and every week, and it's definitely been a key point that we've been focused on through most of 2022. And in some ways, some people might just call it a different culture clash between what used to be acceptable and what the government wants to offer now, but in reality it's nothing but that. And that is a term that's come up again in our firing line, a potential culture clash about just how the government has carried itself and some of the changes it has made to its Bill C-21 firearms legislation that really are starting to raise the question of many people throughout the country. And there has been a consistent push by the Trudeau administration to ban guns, and we've detailed that on the podcast many times before. We talked about the government initially banning guns through an order in council, which is effectively an executive order, and that order banned weapons, things such as anti-tank rocket launchers and rocket launchers themselves. For some reason, those were all banned, and at some point it looked as though the Trudeau government was concerned that people would take up arms, like the rocket launchers and such, and form an armed rebellion against them. So they were banning them. And that's how crazy this legislation was at one point. But it still is causing many other wrinkles around the edges for people this week, as we'll see in this story. And the initial selling pitch on these bans was to ban the so-called assault-style firearms. And if you look at the Canadian media and you look at the people in Canadian government, nobody actually knows what an assault-style firearm is, because there's a lot of people in both those apparatuses, the media and the government, who are just ignorant of guns. And the definition of an assault-style firearm is broad and quite honestly different from person to person and who you ask, whether they're somebody who owns one, whether they're somebody who knows guns, whether they're someone who hates guns, and so on and so forth. It's a different definition for everybody who asks. But in general, an assault-style firearm is a military-based, fully automatic firearm that an officer in the military might use. Now, on the flip side, semi-automatic firearms are firearms where the trigger needs to be squeezed once for each shot. Now, most fully automatic weapons, which are the true assault weapons, are banned in Canada. Hunting rifles and guns used for sport in our country are semi-automatic at best, and some even need to be loaded one shot at a time. Western provinces, including Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, have said that they won't enforce the federal gun ban should it be passed. But this week, more opposition to the ban appeared. Hunters and trappers from the Northern Territories have even voiced opposition this week. Jimmy Kalanick, an Inuvialuit hunter in Inuvik in the Northwest Territories, said that he feels that the proposed changes are an overreach from the government. In particular, he said that my first thought was, that's just ridiculous. A gun is just a gun. It takes a person to use it for violence, to kill people. Now, Laurie Itilout, the NDP MP for Nunavut, said that rifles are not just for hunting. They ensure our safety from predatory animals such as polar bears. There is still time to make this right, and we will keep working to make sure any amendments to the bill will not ban guns primarily used for hunting and for the safety of northerners. We will not support any amendments that disrespect treaty rights and the rights of Indigenous peoples. Now, this highlights the division between the official line that the NDP has with their members and what the government wants to do, and of course what the true realities are in Canada's north. Liberal Northwest Territories MP Michael McLeod said that he's happy with most of the bill, but wants the bill to still be revisited. Liberal Yukon MP Brandon Hanley said that he's heard from hunters, Indigenous leaders, and outfitters who have concerns about the bill, and he said, I'm working with my rural colleagues, I'm working with my fellow MPs on this, and the minister and his staff, and I'm confident that we can make some progress. But he also added that, I'm not happy with this bill, and I'm not in a position to support the bill at this time with those amendments in play. And these are MPs of the government, and the government's confidence and supply partner, the NDP, who are saying they can't support this legislation right now. we also can take this one step further and look at the indigenous community. Chiefs and proxies in attendance of the Assembly of First Nations Special Chiefs Assembly passed what they call an emergency resolution that will oppose the bill. And in particular, the concern is that the bill, as is, would criminalize long guns and infringe on First Nations and treaty rights to hunt and harvest. Now, the government is being criticized for not doing proper consultations with First Nations, which is actually quite interesting because when you look at the government's record on energy, they say that that's why they scrapped projects like Northern Gateway and why they put more regulatory tags on Energy East, which was ultimately scrapped by the company at hand. And this underscores the hypocrisy of this government. Looking at what Chief Tammy Cook of Lac La Ronge Band in Saskatchewan said, she said that our young hunters are growing up. They just don't send them up to the bush with a gun. There's a whole process that has to do with our customs, our values, our traditions. No government has the right to take that away from us and regulate that. That is our job as mothers, grandmothers, grandfathers, and hunters. And because of this quote showcasing what the true reality is on the ground, this has made it to our quote of the week this week. And many people who are consuming the media of the establishment press, just say, would be led to believe that all of Canada was in support of the bill. But based on what we see here in this story, that's clearly not the case. The reason for that assumption is that most of our government governs with the sole focus of downtown Toronto, Montreal, and sometimes downtown Vancouver. The media is also biased in its coverage with reporters and producers who come from those regions. Now, we also have to look at what the House of Commons has to do on this story, and in a final note of hubris and idiocy, the government decided to pass Bill C-21 on what was the 33rd anniversary of the École Polytechnique shooting in Montreal. And of course, this was a horrific shooting in 1989 that took the lives of many women students there. And as a result of that, the government has made the decision to mark that occasion by passing this legislation in what could only be described at this point an insensitive act of virtue signaling, because what it does is it capitalizes on the deaths of those people and wedges so many slices of Canadians against one another. And to just get an idea of how strange this would look in context, this would be like Prime Minister Lester Pearson using the events of something that happened in the Depression to pass legislation when he was Prime Minister. That's what this government is doing. So you factor in what the government has done, what people are saying on the ground, both in terms of Indigenous groups and the local MPs and people who live there. There's definitely a lot of pause going forward on this legislation, but because if you look at what the mainstream media says, you'd believe that all Canadians are for this legislation. Because of that huge discrepancy, that gap that's not being talked about, that's why this has become our firing line this week here on Western Context.
Yes, the misinformation on this story is quite clear when you look at the news, especially from the federal government that claims that Canada is widely on board with this plan. But it's hard to see any support for this plan at all. Like, hardly anybody seems in support of it. Only gun control groups, which have now changed from gun control to complete gun ban with the overreach by the federal government on this issue. It's interesting to see that nobody in the North likes this, nobody in the West likes this, and even people in the cities don't seem to be that overwhelmingly on board with this because they don't really see it as an issue. And many people see the problem with guns in Canada is the illegal guns that are coming over the U.S. border and are in the hands of gangs. And making a law to ban legal guns is not going to change that because it's not like criminals follow the law after all. So something that the government is going to do on this is not going to actually fix the problem. And we're seeing now that First Nations are against this, and even Liberal MPs in the North are even against this. And I think that that's something that it really should be giving the government pause on this, especially in the fact that they're in a minority government situation. They should be looking at what the other parties are saying and, you know, maybe pass some legislation that is a bit more helpful to Canadians and even a bit more popular. And the fact that the Liberals are willing to die on this gun hill is it's quite baffling to see. And it's been going on for years now. And, you know, the real cherry on top is them trying to pass the bill on the anniversary of a shooting that happened 33 years ago. That's something that happened literally a generation ago and is being used as a case to prop up the case for this gun ban. And if it was such a problem back then, one wonders why Liberal governments of Chrétien and Martin didn't do something about this after they gained power in the 1990s, immediately after the shooting. But clearly it wasn't a problem then because of that. And so one has to wonder why it's a problem now and wonder exactly what it is that the government decides to focus on this issue above all else.
Yeah, and once again, it's the government that's trying to just look for the money on the table and take it, except I don't know if there's any money left on the table for them to take. And as a result of that, we're seeing this government get into a phase where they are operating in such a way that it looks like, in many ways, they feel like they're reading the room correctly. But there are many constituency groups here who have voiced opposition that really don't typically voice opposition to the government. And we're starting to see that now, and that should be a huge, huge red flag to the government. And with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is hubris, which is defined as excessive pride or self-confidence. And certainly there's a lot of hubris taking place in the federal government this week, either on healthcare or in when it comes to the gun ban story that they've been working on for quite some time now. And there's a lot of hubris that's been going around in Canada this past week, and certainly a lot of embarrassment that has happened, especially with the Chinese secret police stations that have been uncovered over the country. And I think that there's a lot of hubris going around in the media, too, when it comes to false reporting and definitely some misinformation that has been going around, especially when it comes to Alberta and the Sovereignty Act and the real stories that are happening in Canada that are not getting covered. And I think that that's something that makes hubris a very good word of the week, because it really matters and shows what's going on with the governments in Canada right now.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about stories, different stories each and every week. We talk about the Chinese police stations, we talk about the children's pain medicine, we talk about the gun control, we talk about medical assistance and dying this week. And in reality, all of these are results of what we're seeing in this hubris of the government in terms of it being into its seventh or eighth year at this point, feeling still like they believe they know what is right for the country, when in reality, we're starting to see people raise questions about what's going on that didn't do that before. And as a result of that, we're highlighting that hubris in the government. So with that, I think that's a good word of the week for encapsulating what we covered mostly on this podcast. And as we close out the show, I'll just give a brief reminder yet again that we are running our fall survey at westerncontext.ca/FS. And if you want to help us out with that, it would be greatly appreciated. Just take a few minutes and fill out the survey. Any demographic information we ask for is 100% optional. And once again, that's westerncontext.ca/FS. You can also find full show notes on our website at westerncontext.ca, and just can subscribe to the podcast on any podcast listener out there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, Spotify, and more at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And as we close out, I'll just give a quick mention to our social media, where we post the shows and sometimes some of the stories that we're looking at Western Context on both Twitter and Facebook. And with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
I'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media talks about and a lot that they don't talk about in covering the news that's going on in Canada and how it matters to Canadians, whether they're the stories that we find are in radio, TV, print, or online. We will find them and give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.